Well, we're starting this morning a new series. God willing, over the next few months, we'll be reading together through the book of Daniel. I've got to say, it's one of my very favourite Bible books. Every time I come back to the book of Daniel, I find it fascinating, mind-blowing, awesome. I suppose we all know some of the stories from the book. They're almost the first Bible stories we ever learned. Daniel in the lion's den. The three, or was it four, men in the burning fiery furnace. These are great stories, true stories, thrilling stories. But there's so much more in this book. And you can only really understand those plum stories when you understand the book as a whole. The book opens in the year 605 BC, 605 years before the Lord Jesus was born. But the real beginning of the story was thousands of years earlier. I'm going to ask you to turn back in your Bibles to the very first book in the Bible, the book of Genesis, and chapter 11. Here we are, right back, almost at the beginning of human history, before the human race had split into different nations with different languages. Let me read to you from Genesis chapter 11. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone, and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let's build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth." Remember, this is all following the flood. As a result of the flood, the human race was reduced just to one family, eight people, Noah and his wife and his three sons and the sons' wives. But now the human race is growing again. Don't know how many folk, thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions maybe. We don't know how many human beings there were at this stage. But this human family is migrating slowly eastwards. And they come to the land of Shinar. That's a very ancient name for the country that we call Iraq, in the Middle East, between the rivers Tigris and Euphrates. And they decide that that's where they're going to settle. They're going to build there the great metropolis, the great capital city of the human race. They're going to build a great civilization centered on the plains of Shinar. And they're going to do it without God. They're going to do it simply by using their own human initiative, their own human resources, and their human imagination and skills. They're confident that man has the capacity to build a perfect world for himself, that man can shake off all our limitations, that man can make himself immortal in the end. They believe that human beings are capable of being like gods themselves. It's the great humanist dream, and it was there right back in those days. You see, they've developed new technology. And in the past, if people wanted to build, well, they had to cut out stone painfully. And then they had to shape each stone individually. And then they had to lever it into place. Building out of stone was a long, wearisome process. But now they've discovered a new technology. They found out that you can make bricks out of clay. And then you bake them hard, mass-produced instant stones. And they're all the same shape and they're all the same size, easy to fit together. And they've discovered that you can bind those stones together with bitumen. So, what's their dream? Well, using this new technology, they're going to build the greatest city that had ever existed. And they're going to make a name for themselves. They're going to put themselves in the position where they don't need any god outside to give them an identity. They'll be able to boast, "We are the people who have done this." And they're going to build that city higher and higher. They're going to build a great central tower within the city. A tower which will reach the heavens. Do you understand what they're thinking? They think that by their own efforts they can turn themselves into gods. They can put themselves in the place of God. They've got a very simple picture of the universe. And you've got the earth below where human beings dwell. And you've got the sky like a great dome stretching from horizon to horizon. And beyond the sky, you've got the heavens where God or the gods are supposed to live. Now, right back at the beginning, before Adam and Eve sinned, there was contact between heaven and earth. Adam lived in the Garden of Eden. He lived on the holy mountain. And there in that garden, lifted high above the world, God himself came down and he walked in the garden with Adam. Heaven and earth were in contact there. God met with Adam. Adam walked with God. And God allowed Adam to share his own life. Adam was allowed to eat from the tree of life. And God allowed Adam to share his own authority. Adam was commanded to rule all the creation here below. God said to Adam, "Rule over all the beasts of the field and over all the birds of the air. Subdue the earth, fill it with my authority, in my name." There was nothing in all creation that was outside the control of Adam. Adam could harness all the powers of nature and use them under the authority of God. Everything in creation submitted to Adam. But then came the fall. Adam's rebellion against God. And the fall brought the curse. And the link between heaven and earth was broken. And this earth became a place of misery and illness. A place where animals fight against each other and against man. A place where the forces of nature fight against man, not for him. A place of floods and earthquakes and death. But these men and women gathered at Shinar believe they can change all that. All right, God has cut off his help, if there ever was a God. God has cursed the earth. God is sending these judgments and miseries. Well, we don't need God. We can build our own tower up to heaven. We can rebuild the world as it was before the fall. We can do it by our own resources. See, these men are determined to set themselves up as gods. They're going to take their place in heaven. They're going to control all the forces of nature. They're going to defeat illness and death. They're going to be masters of their own destiny. What a vision, a tower stretching all the way up to heaven so that they can live like gods. But they'll only manage it if they stay together. I mean, they're not stupid. They know that any individual human being, on his own, is a very weak, fragile little creature. They know that left to ourselves, we've got very limited lifespans, that we're not going to be able to fight against the forces of a cursed nature. That's why they're so frightened at the idea that they could be scattered across the earth. They need to stick together. They need to use all their resources together. Together, working as one, they can build this tower to heaven. They can build this colossal city. Together they can overcome their limitations. Man, humanity, the human race can become divine. That's their dream. And they're saying they don't need God. They don't need any gods. Man himself has got everything it takes. If we only stick together, if we only use our combined resources, then we can build the perfect society. So they begin to build with that goal, to make God redundant. As far as they're concerned, God is out of date. God's no longer necessary. God's been made obsolete by the advance of science and technology. Well, you know what happened. We're told, verse 5, that the Lord came down to see the city and to see the tower that these men were building. And God acknowledged that their achievements were remarkable. He says it in verse 6. He says, if as one people speaking the same language, they've begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Yes, in one sense, they could have accomplished their dream. They could have built a world in which the signs of the curse seem to have been eliminated. We don't know what man is capable of. We find it hard to imagine where scientific progress could lead. You know, we're staggered today, aren't we, by what scientists can do in the laboratory. The potential of genetic engineering. And the rate at which computer technologies are progressing. Who knows, maybe as cloning techniques develop, as organs are grown and transplanted, maybe it will be possible for human life to be extended indefinitely. Maybe we will find ways of eliminating famine on this planet, or for that matter of reaching other planets. You know, I came across a quote from Edmund Leach's Wreath Lectures, 1968. 40 years ago, he opened the series of lectures by saying this: men have become like gods. Isn't it time to recognize our divinity? Well, 40 years on, he might well feel that his scientific optimism has been vindicated to a huge extent. God says it here, that left to themselves, nothing they plan will be impossible to them. It's true, man could achieve awesome things in terms of seizing control of nature, in terms of harnessing the powers of the physical universe. Man could bring himself to the point where he doesn't feel that he does need God any longer. But of course it would be an illusion, because human beings do need God. Even if we could eliminate pain and disease and famine from this world, even if we could get rid of all the warning signs of God's judgment, we would still be creatures under God's judgment. We'd still have wicked hearts. We'd still by nature be cruel and selfish and proud. No genetic engineering is going to get rid of those things from the human heart. And we'd still have God against us. We'd still have the wrath of God hanging over us for our rebellion. If we could manage to sort out all the problems of this world, well, we would still be lost creatures, and we'd still be on the way to hell. But these builders, you see, they're not thinking like that. They've just been swept away on this tide of scientific optimism. So they believe that they can simply write God out of the equation completely. They don't need him. Well, you know, God broke up their dream. We're told he confused their language. He left them incapable of communicating with each other. Smashed up their unity. So they scattered. The tower was left standing incomplete. Mute testimony to their failure. The city that had been built around the tower came to be called Babel. Confusion. The place where people go blah, 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 blah. Because they couldn't understand one another. And the human race split into lots of little communities, which became separate nations speaking different languages. You see, the first great attempt to unite the whole human race, to harness all its joint resources, and to make God redundant, had failed. The dream had been broken. But of course, what we've read about here in Genesis 11 was only the first attempt. Ever since then, human history has been the story of people dreaming the same dream and making the same attempt over and over and over again. The people who stayed at Babel when others scattered, they never gave up the dream. In chapter 10, you get a list of the nations that came into being when people were scattered from Babel. And you can read there about a man called Nimrod, who we're told grew to be a mighty warrior on the earth. And it says this about Nimrod: the first centers of his kingdom were Babylon, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in Shinar. But from that land he went on to Assyria, where he built Nineveh and Rehoboth-ir and Calah and Resen. You see, Nimrod's still dreaming the same dream. He's going to build a great global empire based on Babylon or Babel. It's the same word again. Remember, the word Babylon that we've got in our English Bibles is just the word Babel. Well, Nimrod, starting from Babel, is aiming to bring the scattered human race back together as one great empire under his own control. Only now he's going to do it by force of arms. Before, people were holding together voluntarily. But Nimrod's a great warrior, and he's going to use military force to reunite the whole human race under his own leadership. Do you see, Nimrod's still thinking the same way? Individual human beings, virtually helpless. Little communities of human beings, they can't achieve very much. But build one giant empire, pull together the resources of Shinar and of Assyria, of Babylon and Erech and Nineveh, and we can achieve great things, and we can do it without God. That's the way Nimrod thought. And that's the way the rulers of Babylon carried on thinking. We're going to meet in this book of Daniel a king of Babylon called Nebuchadnezzar. And that's the way he thinks. He's still out to build a great global empire in which mankind, headed up by himself, will be self-sufficient. In which an empire in which man will be worshipped in place of God. And then later on in the book of Daniel, we'll meet other great empire builders who've got the same dream. Cyrus of Persia, Alexander of Greece, and the Caesars of Rome. All of them out with the same dream: to build empires in which man can be worshipped in place of God, and in which they themselves can be treated as gods because they're the leaders of the human race. Babel. Except that we usually in English say Babel, don't we? Babel was simply the first example of man's attempt to build a society based on human resources and leaving God out of account. So, Babel or Babylon, say same word, becomes a picture all through the Bible of mankind united against God. Babylon becomes the symbol of human beings working together as an organized society to make God redundant. Babylon equals mankind rebelling together against God. Now, in the opening verses of the book of Daniel, we read about Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, or if you like, simply king of Babel. Said it already, but it's worth repeating again. In English, we talk about the Tower of Babel, but the city of Babylon. But it's one and the same in Hebrew. Babylon is the city built around the Tower of Babel. And Nebuchadnezzar is king of Babel, that city which had been built so many centuries earlier in defiance of God. Now, Babel, Babylon, under Nebuchadnezzar, was fast becoming again the great world power. Nebuchadnezzar had just destroyed the power of the Egyptian Empire at the Battle of Carchemish. So now the Babylonians are in pole position to become the great world empire again. And that's Nebuchadnezzar's dream. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Now, I spent a long time filling in the Bible background to the book of Daniel. But I think we've got to do that, because without that, you're never going to understand even this first verse of the book of Daniel. Here in this verse, Daniel 1:1, you've got a great contrast. We've talked on the one side about Babylon, Babel, the great symbol of human pride, human ambition, human rebellion against God, the city that wants to make God redundant. But we also read here about another city, Jerusalem, the city that God chose to be his own city, the city where God had his own temple, his dwelling place, his palace, the city where God reigned, the city where God's people gathered and worshipped him. If Babylon is the picture in the Bible of human society in rebellion against God, Jerusalem is the picture in the Bible of God's people, the alternative human society, the society that lives under the reign of God. Babylon is the community of people who worship man and his achievements, who trust human resources. Jerusalem is the community of people who worship God in his majesty and trust in God's infinite power and grace. And each of these two cities has a ruler, a head, a leader. Babylon is ruled over by a series of brutal emperors, from Nimrod down to Nebuchadnezzar. Brutal men, violent men, proud men, tyrants. Jerusalem, on the other side, is ruled over by a line of kings descended from David. Here we read about Jehoiakim, king of Judah, the Davidic tribe. Now, Jehoiakim personally wasn't a great king at all. He wasn't a wise king. But he was a true king of David's line, the line that was going to lead to the Messiah. He was the king that God had appointed to rule over his people in his name. Do you see the contrast? Two cities. Babylon, the city of man, ruled over by a king who sees himself as the epitome of human greatness. And Jerusalem, the city of God, ruled over by the king whom God himself had appointed to be his representative. And here, in this verse, you've got Babylon at war with Jerusalem. Here you've got Babylon determined to take over Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar is determined that Jerusalem will be absorbed into his great empire. He's determined that the king of Jerusalem, the Davidic king, will be subject to himself. In Nebuchadnezzar's mind, there's no place for any independent people. There's no place for any independent city. It's all got to be brought into his great humanistic, man-worshipping empire. Oh, he doesn't mind the city of Jerusalem existing. He doesn't mind if people in Jerusalem say, well, we belong to Jerusalem, we live there, it's God's city. Providing that then they add, and of course Jerusalem is subject to Babylon. He doesn't mind them having the son of David as their king. Providing that they add, but of course our king can be overruled by the emperor of Babylon any time. You know, Nebuchadnezzar was a tolerant king in many ways. He didn't normally destroy the cities he captured. He just absorbed them into his empire. They could carry on maintaining their own culture, their own gods, providing that they accepted always the values of Babylon, the authority of Babylon. He didn't normally remove the kings he defeated. He left them in place as puppet kings to organize their own people on his behalf. He wanted to absorb, to draw in these cities and their kings. If he couldn't do that, eventually he might move to destroy them. But his first strategy was always absorption, not destruction. In his dream of the great world empire, well, yes, there was a place for Jerusalem, just as there was a place for all the other cities that he had defeated. But Jerusalem would always have to be subject to his man-worshipping philosophy. Jerusalem would always have to accept the values that have dominated Babylon ever since Genesis 11. So we read, Nebuchadnezzar came up and besieged Jerusalem. Babylon makes war on Jerusalem. Babylon's king makes war on the son of David. The goal at this stage isn't to destroy Jerusalem. It's not to remove Jerusalem's king. The goal is to absorb Jerusalem into his empire. The goal is to make Jerusalem's king his own puppet. Jerusalem and Babylon. This opening verse sets out the theme of the whole book of Daniel. This book is all about the great war that goes on all down the centuries. The war between Jerusalem and Babylon. The war between God's people who are determined to worship God alone and human societies which are determined that we shall worship man and his values and his achievements. The war between people who live under the headship of Jesus Christ, the Son of David, and a world that sets up their own rulers who are determined to make Christ an irrelevance. You see, the war that we're reading about in Daniel 1:1 is a war that's still being fought. And we're still caught up in it. Babylon is no longer a single physical city. But still everywhere across the globe, human beings unite against God. They group themselves together to make God redundant. They still aim to build societies in which human achievement will be the final arbiter of everything. They still want to believe that human intellect is supreme. They still want to believe that human potential is unlimited. They still want to believe that human beings have the capacity to decide for themselves what is good and what's evil. They still want to believe that human nature is self-sufficient. Here in the West, in our organized Western society, people actually boast that they're humanists, that they need no God beyond man himself. They still look for human leaders who will solve all their problems, leaders whom they can worship. And Jerusalem, likewise, is no longer a physical city made up of people from one nation. The community of God's people is spread across the world. It's made up of people from every nation. People who have turned away from human resources to submit to God alone and to trust in God alone. It's made up of people who know that they can never save themselves, and so they've thrown themselves upon God's mercy. They're people who live under the headship, under the rule of Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of David. The church, made up of real believers, true Christians from all nations. The church is the new Jerusalem, the real Jerusalem. And Babylon, godless society, is still determined to defeat Jerusalem. It tries first to absorb Jerusalem, to persuade the citizens of Jerusalem, that's us, if we're believers. It tries to persuade us to accept its values, to worship its leaders, to adopt its attitudes. It wants us just to become Babylonians. And then if that fails, then society will turn and seek to destroy Jerusalem through persecution. But one way or another, Babylon, human beings determined to worship man alone, Babylon will never accept a Jerusalem that proclaims that God is supreme and that God alone is to be worshipped. And that there is no way of escaping from the curse other than through Jesus Christ. We're going to see, as we read this book, how individuals get caught up in that war. You see it in this first chapter. When Nebuchadnezzar comes up and besieges Jerusalem, he arrests, rounds up, the brightest, most able young men from the city of Jerusalem. Some of them are lads from the royal family itself. Why does Nebuchadnezzar want to round these lads up? So that he can kill them? Because he sees them as a threat? No. That's not his idea at all. He wants to take them back to Babylon with him. And there, he'll turn them into good Babylonish citizens. He takes them back to Babylon. He hands them over to the chief of his civil service. And he says, now your job is to take these barbarians, these primitives, these people who worship their invisible God, and you've got to turn them into people like us. They've got to be taught all the language and literature of the Babylonians. They've got to be brainwashed. They've got to be conditioned by reading all the myths and all the philosophical works and all the entertaining novels that are produced in Babylon. These lads from Jerusalem have got to be taught to think like Babylonians, to have the mindset of Babylonians. Instead of their minds being taught and trained by God's word, by the Holy Scriptures, instead of meditating on those scriptures night and day, they're going to spend their nights and days now in Babylonian libraries studying the dusty works of Babylonian philosophers. Because they've got to be trained to have the mindset of Babylonians. And they've got to learn to enjoy the lifestyle and the culture of the Babylonians. Life in Jerusalem, life among the people of God back in the land of Israel, in many ways was a relatively austere life. Yes, there were many delightful things to enjoy. It was a land flowing with milk and honey. But there was this code of commandments, detailed commandments, laying down exactly what citizens of Jerusalem could eat and couldn't eat. A godly young man of Jerusalem, he would know that his purpose in life was not just to have pleasure, that all his pleasures had to be submitted to the law of God, that he could only enjoy those things which God gave him to enjoy. The lifestyle of Babylon was very different. The thinking of Babylon was just enjoy yourself. Eat as much as you want. Drink as much as you want. Don't stint yourself or restrict yourself in any way. Your job here in this world is to enjoy all that Babylon's got to give. And these young men from Jerusalem have got to be conditioned into that way of looking at the world. They've got to be provided with the very best food and the wine that Babylon has to offer. They've got to learn to enjoy the pleasures of Babylon. And then they've got to start thinking of themselves always as having their primary loyalty to Babylon, not to Jerusalem. That's why they're given new names. We're told here about four young men. One of them was called Daniel. Well, now he's called Belteshazzar. One was called Hananiah. Now he's called Shadrach. One was called Mishael. Now he's called Meshach. One was called Azariah. Now he's called Abednego. The Hebrew names they did have had the name of God built into each one of them. Well, now they've got to have Babylonish names in which the name of God has been pushed out of sight. They've got to be given a new identity. These are only young lads when they're taken away from Jerusalem. Maybe early teens, maybe mid-teens. The hope is that as the years go by, as they fit into Babylonish society, bit by bit they'll forget their home. They'll forget Jerusalem. They'll forget their old identity. And they'll just think of themselves as people who belong in Babylon. And then finally, when they've taken in the whole mindset of Babylon, when they've adopted the whole lifestyle of Babylon, when they've got their identity firmly confirmed as Babylonian, then they'll be able to serve the king of Babylon. That's what we're told in verse 5. That's the purpose, that they should enter the king's service and give themselves to work for the king of Babylon. Imagine it. These are lads who belong in Jerusalem. These are lads who belong in the community of God's people. These are lads whose roots are there in the holy city, whose first loyalty on earth is to the Son of David. And these lads, if Nebuchadnezzar gets his way, are going to finish up thinking like Babylonians, behaving like Babylonians, serving the king of Babylon. They're going to be indistinguishable from Babylonians. Bit by bit, they're going to forget what it means to belong to Jerusalem. Bit by bit, they're just going to be absorbed into the life of Babylon. They're going to use their gifts and abilities not to further God's kingdom, but to further the dream of Babylon's king. That's Nebuchadnezzar's plan. What a strategy it is. Brilliant, isn't it? Yeah, he could have just ordered his troops to go across the world, just destroying every rival city. But that's not what he's after. He's after taking hold of people wherever they are and drawing them in, making them think like himself. Well, we'll see next week, God willing, how these young men resisted that strategy. How determined they were to remember that they were citizens of Jerusalem. How determined they were that they weren't going to let themselves become brainwashed and conditioned by the society in which they had to live. Yes, they had to live in Babylon. There was no way around that. They had to live in this great city, and they could still see towering in its centre the Tower of Babel. Still stood back in those days, reaching up towards the sky. They could see all around them the symbols of man's achievements, the glories of Babylon. They could see the wonderful riches. They could see just what amazing entertainments and delights there were available. They had to live in Babylon. And yet they had to be remembering constantly that Babylon wasn't their home. We belong with God's people. We belong in Jerusalem. This king of Babylon, yes, we honour him in his earthly role, but he isn't our king ultimately. Our loyalty is given to David's son, to the one whom God has appointed as king. Our loyalty is given to the King of Kings, the Lord of Heaven. They've got to remember that constantly. And even when physical Jerusalem lay in ruins, because Nebuchadnezzar did have to destroy Jerusalem in the end, even then, years later, they still got to remember Jerusalem, and their hearts have still got to be there. Daniel, years and years later, is still going to be opening his windows towards Jerusalem, morning and noon and night, and remembering, that's where I belong. And praying that God will one day restore Jerusalem. What a seductive society we live in. If we're believers in Jesus Christ, then we belong in heaven. Our citizenship is in heaven, says Paul. If we belong to Jesus Christ, then our values are completely different from the values of the world around us. The things that we think are important aren't the things that the world thinks are important. And the things that the world thinks are important aren't the things that we think are important. Our pleasures aren't their pleasures. And their pleasures aren't our pleasures. Their priorities aren't our priorities. And our priorities aren't their priorities. That's the way it has to be. Jerusalem isn't part of the Babylonian Empire. Jerusalem is part of the heavenly empire. And Jerusalem is ruled over by one king, Jesus Christ, the only worthy king. And we are his subjects. We have to remember that. We have to remember that as the world piles on all the pressure, as it uses the media, and as it uses the schools, and as it uses the machinery of local government, as it uses every conceivable means to tell us, you've got to be the same as us. You've got to be fascinated by the same film stars that we're fascinated by. You've got to have your hope in the same medical advances that we have our hope in. You've got to think of the future of the world in the same way as we think of the future of the world. You've got to worship money just as we worship money. All the time the world is pressing in upon us, just as Nebuchadnezzar hammered on the gates of Jerusalem, so the world is hammering on our gates all the time. We've got to be conscious of it. As we go on and as we think about these young men living in Babylon, we're going to be thinking about the ways in which they resisted the pressures of the world upon them, the way in which they stood out against the conditioning of Babylon. But the first step is surely to realise that it's there. The first step is simply to realise that that is the war we're caught up in. The first step is surely just to realise that there is this orchestrated, determined attempt to absorb us. And it's working. It's working throughout evangelical Christendom. See so many who call themselves believers And yet in terms of their lifestyles, in terms of their thinking, in terms of their priorities, in terms of the way they bring up their family, they're indistinguishable from the people of the world. And in terms of the image of the church that they want to present, it's indistinguishable from the image that every secular institution wants to present. And we see it in our own souls, don't we? We see how hard we find it to be seen to be different. How hard we find it to stand out like a sore thumb and to be thought of as strange and odd. It's hard, isn't it? Well, that's the warfare. That's the warfare that's gone on ever since Genesis 11. It's the warfare that's going to go on until our King returns. And until he's crowned as king, not just over his church, but crowned as king over a universe that he's redeemed. The warfare goes on. We've got to be aware of the fact that we're caught up in that warfare, as much as Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah were 2,600 years ago.